Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Daly.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jürgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graeme Hunter.
Thank you, Jürgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graeme Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests and to me via the monthly Q&A. So do please go to patreon.com/Graeme Hunter and join the club, and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you. Hi everybody, welcome back to The Big Interview. It's Graeme here. This time my guest is Graeme Le Saul, a title winner with Blackburn Rovers, a Cup Winners' Cup winner with Chelsea, an England international at left back. But in part one of this interview, the two of us wanted to talk about his latest incarnation. Graeme is an executive director at Mallorca, where he is part of an innovative team steering that club's mission to gain a strong foothold in La Liga. As you'll hear, that means an international effort drawing from big brains in business and the NBA to build a club that is always looking to the next phase of the plan. It doesn't just sound interesting, it's working. As I record this, Mallorca have just beaten Atletico Madrid, Spain's champions, in the Spanish capital. Talking to Graeme Russo, I was hugely impressed. He fascinated me. I think you'll have the same reaction. Here's part one of Graeme Le Saul.
It's The Big Interview. Listeners, hi again. The guest is more important, but I'm looking at a kind of big black globe with a red eye staring at me that H.G. Wells could have invented, because Neil has bought a new recording device. So maybe I sound like Orson Welles or Peter Ustinov now because the device is so clever. But that's irrelevant compared to the guest we have today. We're happy and privileged to have Graeme Le Saul with us. Thank you, Graeme, for taking time out of what we've just been talking about. is a very rich and varied London life. I'm jealous of it, but how the hell have you found time for us? Like, maybe it's the quality of the mint tea.
It definitely is, yeah. And the respect I have for you, so thank you for inviting me.
Ooh, steady now. Whoa,
there you go. I do reserve the right to withdraw that comment after the interview.
You see, that's the calibre. Okay, you've taken me to the first subject, because there's so much that's been interesting and successful about a life and a career really well spent. You're a talented, articulate man. But you're also doing something that, or you have been doing something that really excites me, because of the many and varied participants in La Liga or the Segunda, Mallorca is one that in a way has been ignored a little bit, because it's easier to forget about a club that's on an island. Over the years, prior to your involvement with some pretty illustrious partners and friends, it hasn't been run all that well. There was a time when they were ultra successful. Everybody will have forgotten that they reached a European final within our working.
Because we played against them in the semi-final for Chelsea.
I was going to come to that, I must admit. But you won another trophy, so it done. But you've been helping run, revive Mallorca. One, why? And two, what kind of taste is it? What kind of fun is it?
So, in answer to the first question, why, obviously, you know, my life is football. The passion for playing has been transferred to a passion for sort of work, staying within the game. So I work with NBC, the American broadcaster covering the Premier League. So I'm equally as passionate with my work for NBC as I was playing. Want to continue to learn about the game, improve and see where I can help. And then my passion with the work that I do with Real Mallorca and the ownership is another opportunity for me to really learn and evolve and understand a different part of the game, a different perspective, and see what my experiences have been as a player from the perspective I've had, what I can then, I suppose, pass on into a football club in a longer term, I suppose, project. Mm-hmm. And not looking at it as much from my own perspective as what's in the best interests of the club. Mm-hmm. And so there's so many different layers to being involved in a football club. So I got involved initially because a good friend of mine who I worked with at NBC, Kyle Martino, mm-hmm. Is very good friends with Steve Nash, the basketball player, and Stuart Holden, the former Bolton player.
I like to think of him as Aberdeen man, Aberdeen Stuart Holden, man. Because exactly. That's what he is. But exactly. I admit other things have interfered in his life, yeah.
And it was just a sort of a series of fortunate sort of connections, or unfortunate connections, depending on who you're looking at it, you know, from which perspective you're looking at it from.
Fortunate,
I think. And I ended up having a conversation with one of the owners who had just bought Real Mallorca, Robert Sava, who was in London, about the potential for working with them on the club that they just acquired. Hmm. I've had a long history of spending time, family time in Mallorca over 25 years. Hmm. So know a lot of people on the island, local people, always kept an eye on the club in terms of how it was doing and what was going on without really ever understanding that. And it just sort of, you know, everything aligned and... At the lowest point of the Mallorca ownership was they got relegated to Segunda B. And I'd already had some conversations with Robert and Andy Kohlberg, the other, who's the president of the club and the other owner, main owner. And we had a meeting in California. I was out there with my family. And I sat down with Andy and Steve Nash and they said, look, we actually really do want you to be involved. Can you, you know, and I was thinking Segunda B, that's, you know, regional football.
Yeah.
And I was in my heart, I was thinking, well, how can I help you at this point?
Yeah.
You know, because it meant them taking...
Well, because your experience as a player has been elite.
Yeah, right?
and there's a big chasm.
It was not from a point of view of being... There was no snobbery attached to that. It was more, you know, the level of detail you're working at, are they prepared to invest in that, given that the team's in Segunda B? And I remember sitting down with them and saying, you've got to make this the best thing that's ever happened to you.
Good.
Because you've got an opportunity to start from a blank, you know, with a blank canvas and build the club that you want to build. And that meant changing the culture, changing the trajectory and giving people something to be optimistic for rather than frustration that I think was very much part of the club, frustration from the fans because the team was underperforming, frustration within certain quarters, good people trying to do work and the culture not allowing them to do that. So we worked on that principle, and the coach that came in, Vicente Moreno,
talented man,
he did, you know, came in that first season. The club had brought in players that have been incredible. We've still got four players, I think, who were with us in Segunda B. You know, Salva Sevilla. You know, he's probably the pick of the bunch in that sense.
Just for those, you describe him, but for those who don't have the chance to watch La Liga at the moment or didn't see him, I think, Espanol, we're talking about somebody who just understands space and the ball, his touch is good. Mm. Age seems to be of irrelevance to him.
Yeah.
38, 39,
exactly,
maybe
yeah,
38, even more.
38, I think he is.
Nicks about the pitch because he's clever about where he goes and uses the ball delightfully. At the weekend, just before we spoke, or over the last couple of games, he scored peaches of goals.
Yeah, he's so
He's so talented. As you say, his awareness of the game, awareness of space, technical ability, and physically, you know, at 38, he's still, you know, he's a lot fitter than most 38-year-olds. Obviously, the problem is when you're coming up against younger players in those midfield roles, there's a physical element that sometimes is holds him back, shall we say.
Yeah.
But it's always like anything in sport, there's risk reward ratios in everything.
Yeah.
So do you risk the physical to get the reward of the technical?
Mm-hmm.
And that's down to the coach to work that out. But you know, these players that we had as part of the core of the squad then have been absolutely incredible. They're the foundation of all of the success that we've had in the last five years. And of course, success is relative, but to bounce straight from third to second, and then we went second to first back to second, and then second back to first. So we've got this environment that, you know, my role, I suppose, if I was to describe my role, it's to try to help create a sustainable, successful football club, not doing well. because we've been in a different division every year for the last five.
Even if our listeners haven't followed it in detail and can't contest that, I should, because the effort about staying up was extraordinary.
Mm.
Mallorca and the year they went down were attractive. They were clearly robust. It came down to very late. It came down to probably insufficient use of the Japanese winger, who's a real talent, and it took a while for the coach to... But I need to stop you because you used the phrase, maybe the culture at Mallorca was slowing things down. It wasn't quite right. Certainly explain what you mean by that if you want. But if you then jump to the coming up from Segunda to the Primera the first time, where, if I'm not wrong, Deportivo La Coruña is the opponent in the playoffs up in Galicia, it's quite a comprehensive 2-0, I think.
Yeah.
And reasonably comprehensive.
Absolutely.
And then the big game, like the cup final, which is the equivalent of the what do you call it here, the championship at Wembley and whatever. You have to take them on the island. You're 2-0 down to starts. It's an extraordinary night, but the culture, as well as the effort, as well as the skills, the belief that we can do this, nothing is beyond us. To me, that was one of the outstanding Spanish games of the last six or seven years.
It was incredible. Like you say, comfortably beaten 2-0 in Deportivo. And had a man sent off, I think after about 60 minutes or so, which was incredible because I think that started the revival, because we didn't concede after that. We kept it at two, and it meant that the player that was sent off, Pedraza his name was, didn't play in the second leg, but young Idrissa Baba, who's now making a real name for himself as a holding midfield player, He played in that second leg at St Mosh, and he played an outstanding game of football that day. He played like two people, because he's known as the octopus, Il Pulpo, and he's just got he at his best. He covers the pitch so well, receives the ball in tight areas, and is a very good player. And that was, I don't think he would have played if Pedraza hadn't been sent off. So one man's misfortune is someone else's opportunity. And it was funny because Deportivo had, I think, the best defensive record in Segunda. And to be 2-0 up, for us to have to score three, was almost a mountain that people had written us off. And we scored, we were all there, the owners were there, and I was sat next to one of the other owners, a gentleman called Glenn. And everyone was obviously excited, nervous. And we scored in the first half, and we were playing really well. We went in at half time at 1-0, and I remember the owner saying to me, "We needed the second." I went, "No, one at half time is perfect, because it doesn't change the team talk. Two, and you're drawing. Suddenly, that team talk at half time becomes really critical.
Do we push?
Do we hold? Do we at 2-1? We had the same mentality, and we played fantastically. But even then, At 3-2, Deportivo had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
They had a header that missed the post by about 3 inches, with our goalkeeper rooted to the spot. And that's the margin that you're dealing with. They're the margins in the end that you're dealing with. And you can't. And this is why I talk about culture. And I'm sort of, I always try to look beyond the result. because yeah. because it, at the end, if we'd not got promoted because of that header, would that change how we run the club?
It
no.
shouldn't, should it?
No, but it, unfortunately in football, some, I think it does. Do.
Yeah.
And so very much part of what we've been trying to do from day one is build a plan that is process-driven, not without passion, because when you talk about process, you sort of think, well, that means you take the emotion out. No, not at all.
No.
But you talk about doing things in a certain way in certain areas that give you a better chance of succeeding in the long run. Now, you know, did we predict, or did we really presume we were going to get from third to second to first in two moves? No. But did we try to make the most of that and plan as much as we could as that was looking like it was a possibility? Because we finished fifth that season. So, you know, we got into the playoffs as one of the second lowest ranking team in the playoffs. And we took full advantage of the opportunity, but then we had to suddenly change gear and change speed once we got up into La Liga. And that is always going to be the hardest thing, is when you get promoted, how much resilience can you build in ahead of time to then make yourself best prepared for the next division? And that is the ultimate challenge. Now, this is our second time we've come up in two seasons. So my ambition was always with all those people that we work with to be in a better place this time than we were last time. And yes. Is that enough?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? You know, we'll be midway through the season come Christmas, and we'll have a much better idea of where we fit in the jigsaw of the league by then.
Aside from the things that are being done structurally or commercially, culture changing, the club seems to have been quite adept about squad rebuilding, and in terms of when to spend, whether to spend, how to loan. I don't know what you think about Pablo Ortells, but he came in and had a role, and at least from having been very successful at Villarreal, two stand out for me, because Kang-in Lee, or Lee Kang-in, if you respect the Korean culture of the order of the names, and Taki Kubo. I've got a particular debility for Taki Kubo, because I think that he's one of these players that you have to ignore the fact that he's quite diminutive. And modern football can make that harder. You have to be ultra clever as well as talented and quick. And at the moment he's injured, but I've seen him respond differently to how well he shows his abilities depending on how well he thinks the coach trusts him. I think he's very much somebody who needs to believe, right, he loves me, therefore I'm going to give everything. And Lee, the South Korean, whose talent is evident, is very irascible, loves a red card, occasionally does things where you're like, yes, right, there's no question about your vision, your passing ability, your wit in closed spaces, but they're both risks to a degree. But I expect you might tell me that if the squad is well built and well coached with Luis Garcia, great Tom Hanks impersonator. In fact, there was a brilliant Mallorca Elche game the other day where it was Tom Hanks against Michael Aspel. I don't know if you've seen Elche's coach, but he is Michael Aspel. Those two interest me. What do you think about their trajectory? What do you think about how they're playing?
So first of all, with Pablo, we interviewed for Sporting Director. I'm laughing because it was, it seems, trying to think, the lockdown.
We've had an odd couple of years.
I mean, so I've lost all time frame. So he came in at a time when we'd been through the first lockdown. We were in the bottom places and invariably got relegated. Vicente went, so we interviewed Pablo and other candidates, and Pablo, between ownership and you know, myself, the board, we felt was the right person to represent what we wanted in terms of the development of the squad over the next period of time. Knowledge of the market, knowledge of La Liga, and obviously so well connected with all of his experience that he had in the Villarreal setup. This window, again, you get promoted, you look at, which positions are priorities for us, and we've brought in quite a few players during the summer window, and what is the... what is the sort of... So you've picked two really good examples there, because obviously Kubo is a lone player from Real Madrid. So it's a short-term in relationship with him in one sense, mm-hmm. but it's the second time we've had him on loan. So we've watched his development. We know the personality. We know the character from the first loan. We're confident in his attitude and his work rate, his ethic, and his value to the team in that sense. And then he's developing as a player. You know, at 20, 21, he's gaining more and more experience. And so, therefore, to your point, how consistent is he at delivering the obvious talent that he has, and how does that fit in with what else we've got? And we've seen him as a player that we are investing in impact. You know, we want him to deliver. And with both of them, they're both players that need the coach to feel that he values them. You know, I think the best relationships between coaches and their players, particularly young players, is that fatherly, paternal mm-hmm. relationship. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean they're not tough on them. No. It doesn't mean they're not, you know, demanding higher standards. But there's an affection and a relationship that is special, because you're helping that player develop, and you've got to give them the ability to especially creative players to yeah. take risks, to try things, to pick themselves up when they've fallen down, go again, to keep wanting the ball, be brave. And both of them are. If you watched Kang In Lee the last game against Elche, he takes up some great positions and he wants the ball. He's on the half turn all the time. And we're trying to be a team. Our identity as a team is to be an aggressive, mm-hmm. Forward-thinking team, playing vertically, not passive football. And you see that a lot. You know, I'm learning about Spanish football culture, and my culture and my background is about, you know, high intense pressing, getting the ball forwards early, taking opportunity to risk passes, to high turnover in the Premier League of the ball. Completely different to Spanish
culturally. It's very culturally different, yeah.
But I believe wholeheartedly that Spanish football is changing, and has been for a while, that there is more, you know, there is more sort of tempo over 90 minutes, more aggression, more physicality, more risk taking, and we're a team that believes in that. The coach believes in it, we believe in it, and these type of players are really important to get the best out of that system, and to play between the lines forwards, you know, and it comes with risk. It comes with a lot of risk. Younger players, you know, will make mistakes, you know. Physically, you've got to adapt players to the intensity of the game. So it's for both of them, it's going to be a case of building that resilience. And unfortunately, as you said, Kubo had against Real Madrid, funnily enough, had an awkward twist and damaged his knee. So there's a period of time that he's out for. But ultimately, for him coming in on loan is the message is obvious. We need him to play. We need him to play and be important.
But if I was streetwise, if I were, I wish I were, I would say that I've seen stranger scenarios. He can't play at Real Madrid at the moment, irrespective of where would he fit, and Vinicius and Rodrigo and Haaland's coming, and look at Mbappe's coming to all that pitch.
Yeah.
They can't afford him because he's not a community player. And they've used up all their slots. There have been stranger scenarios whereby they still can't and still can't and still can't. You got another year of loan. They go, listen, we'll let you have him for X many million. There is a real possibility that he stays a Mallorca player.
Yeah, the thing is, we're always, with every loan player, we're always looking at how we can make that relationship more valuable than just the period of loan.
And that's mutually, not just for the
mutually.
Club.
No, mutually. Absolutely. Because ultimately, you know, we're in a position, you know, economically, our ranking, all of those things, our environment, we've got to box clever. We've got to find ways of developing players, of having relationships, getting players in that are above our pay grade, shall we say, that we can build, you know, we can build a trust with. And so again, I think the biggest compliment we can have as a football club is that Take was with us 2 years ago and wanted to come back. And that relationship is fundamental to him coming to play with us. Mm-hmm. His status in the team in terms of the games he'll get, and of course always based on merit, always based on the coach's decision, absolutely. But you you know, we feel that the relationship is what has given us the opportunity to bring him back into the squad, and that's a massive tick in the box of how we're operating as a football club. And but with every player, of course, my first question is, you know, if he has a good year, what's the option?
Yeah.
What can we do?
Be ready.
Because it would be really poor show if we didn't do that, I think. And look, over the next few years, the first priority is to stay in La Liga.
Yeah.
Of course, that has to be fundamental. But sitting behind that has to be, how do we stay in La Liga and build quality? How do we build depth in our positions? How do we improve in every area? So whether it's, you know, the left backs, how do we improve our left backs over the next 3-5 years? But equally, it could be recruitment. Can we work on a recruitment process that's more sophisticated, more successful? Medical, are we doing the right things there? Whatever it is, all the departments have to always be under scrutiny to improve, because that's what creates consistency on the pitch. And that's the joy of it, because I love it. I have to say, it's so fulfilling. But at the same time, there's a different stress, because I can't do anything about it on a match day. Whereas actually, I would always say I could. I can always stop a goal. I can always mark the best player on the pitch, and I can always create something for someone else to score. Whereas now, that whistle goes, and I'm sat there like everyone else, going and hiding behind my sofa on many occasions.
Before the rest of this big interview, I'd like to tell you that our entire archive of audio and video content is now on our new YouTube channel. We've begun filming all of our interviews, and there are already loads of clips with guests, including Rio Ferdinand, Connor Cody, Brendan Rodgers and Jamie Carragher, plus full interviews for you to watch and to share. Please do share with friends. Go to YouTube and search Graham Hunter, or click on the link in the show notes to this episode and become a subscriber. I honestly think you'll enjoy it. Thanks.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's a good stress, I think, and it's nice to build. It's nice when you build to be in a position at least to say to people, well, that person or this department deserves time. I believe in them. I'm really pissed off that we lost 1-0 at home to Elche, but no, we process. A little request would be, please save Chelsea's star Billy Gilmore from his hell at Norwich and half a season in the league. I would have thought, but because... Yeah. Joking aside, becoming a trusted club where certain other big clubs think, we can help the process because we'll get something back again. That's probably what you're aiming at. I think before leaving Mallorca, because there's so much to talk about in terms of you, what is the other team like then? The team of Andy and Robert and people, some people will know about Nash, some won't. Stewart, some people will know about because he played excellently until injury treated him brutally. I think Rafa Nadal and Miguel Angel are there or thereabouts, and Tony, they are islanders, and I'm not sure how formal their involvement is, but they are vocal, they're high profile. that's, if you include yourself, that's quite a conglomeration of experience and talent and ideas and determination.
Yeah. So we run very much by consensus, which is great. We have the ownership have a huge amount of trust in the day-to-day operations of the club. Alfonso Diaz, who's the CEO, Pablo, obviously sporting director, myself, I work between ownership and the guys on the ground. So it's all based on a I think a consensus of trust, of strong opinion, of getting behind something that we all agree on. So once there's a debate about something, once we've settled on a pathway, we all fall in behind that decision, because that's really important. The problem is, I think if you're seeking, you know, a consensus, or you're seeking opinions and you want people to be confident in giving their viewpoint and really challenging, you've also got to then, when you come to a decision, you've also got to make sure that everyone falls in behind that and gives 100% support. So that is something, again, that I do naturally. I would always do that. I would never say I have the answer to something, but you better believe if you ask me to find out about something, I'm going to go and research it well. I'm going to put together my argument. I'm going to say why I believe in this. I'm going to evidence it, and then I'm going to want you to challenge that and challenge it properly, because otherwise I'm going to feel, oh, hang on, you know, don't just say no, because that's not what we don't do that. That's not good enough, you know.
So that's this particular culture you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
The culture you've just identified in the last 4 and 5 minutes is not the general culture in football.
No, but it's
clubs that you've experienced.
No, absolutely. Which you know, there's not the hierarchy that you would expect in a lot of
consensus. It largely doesn't matter, and people will tell you instantly, "Oh, it doesn't work." You've got that. You're finding, but at the moment you're finding it. You're finding it that it functions.
Absolutely.
That it feels nourishing, that it feels a good place, and whether it's disputes or different opinions, you've found a way to incorporate everything and make a democracy like that work.
Yep. And again, it doesn't hamper decisions. That's the key thing, because you can talk about something, you know, let's have a round table and chat for ages, never make a decision.
Yeah.
At the end of it, the board, the owners, have to make a decision.
Yeah, but you're all in your, from you to the Americans and the New Yorkers, we're talking about, you know, multi-million pound businessmen used to being successful, used to having their word listened to and taken. Yeah. I'm sure it's quite a busy, forward-moving environment when you're looking for that
consensus.
Absolutely.
And credit to them, you know, really credit to them. You know, Andy is a former professional tennis player. Yeah. He has a sporting mentality, and he understands. You know, he would say that he's learning all the time about football. They're in the Phoenix Suns basketball team. You know, so they're in elite sport, but basketball and football, very different animals. Different, you know. So where I credit both Andy and Robert and the other shareholders is that they're open-minded. Mm-hmm. They're really open-minded to and want to understand. They don't just say, well, look, this is what we do here, so this is what you have to do here.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, we're all learning from them and their experience in their businesses, with the Phoenix Suns. You know, what a rich vein of knowledge that we can sort of gain from. So, again, it's about applying expertise in the right areas, isn't it? So I find my value is about understanding the culture of a dressing room, the impact of decisions on the dressing room. How do we manage the transition from a group of players to a new group of players as we evolve? Mm-hmm. So all these wonderful players I was talking about, the 4, 5, 6 players and they're legends within our club. You know, Cisco Campos, who was our captain for many years, you know, he is Mallorcan through and through, cares about that club so much. And, you know, he got to a point, he's a centre back, got to a point where we got promoted and it was obvious that he couldn't play for us at that point, you know. And that was out of admiration for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've spent, and we've spent the last 2 years communicating with Cisco all the time as he carried on playing football, because I said to him, look, if you stop playing football and when you feel you can carry on playing, you'll always regret that. So go and play football and then keep in touch, and we'll always
he's always going to be part of the fabric of that club, whether it's officially, unofficially, whether he has a role or not. He, you know, because ultimately those people are fundamental. If they're the right people,
mm-hmm.
that has to be the case.
Yeah.
They have to have the right sort of, I suppose, values as well.
But West Ham fans of my generation will be thinking, yeah, we used to see Bobby Moore sitting up in the top of the stands because he wasn't welcome back at the club. And no. So again, everything you're explaining makes common sense.
Mm.
People will be going, yeah, that's right. I don't know Cisco very well, but Graham's right that it doesn't work like that. Football clubs treat you like once you're in your litter.
Yeah.
Not but, always, but often.
Yeah, and for me, again, I can only draw my own experiences and I can think what helped me and what was good about experiences and what were the negatives of some experiences as well, and then try and do it differently, you know, where I can and where I think it's of value. Now, we had a really difficult time, as every football club did, when the game stopped.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with players. In Spain, they took salary cut in Spain.
Almost across the board.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you imagine how delicate that conversation was with the players.
Yeah.
Because the players, they're like, well, you know, we wanna play.
Yeah.
We haven't invented this, you know. So navigating through that conversation and coming out the other side without damage is really, really difficult. But also being honest enough to explain to the players that the financial impact on the club itself and therefore ownership is real.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get that balance between you know, maintaining our sort of responsibilities to the players and their salaries versus keeping everyone employed for that period of time, coming back and playing without fans for a period of time, therefore loss of revenue. And I think, well, if I was in the dressing room, I'd just want you to be honest with me.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to respect me and be honest. And then I've got a chance of, if I'm one of the captains, which I was at Chelsea for many years, the leadership group, we've got a leadership group. I'm thinking, if I'm one of those leaders within that dressing room, if you give me the information, I've got a chance of convincing those guys that they're not just doing it because they've got an opportunity to save some money.
To cut costs.
They're doing this because of this, this and this. And again, it's part of a relationship. Now, it's not, you have to stand up to people as well. You have to be prepared to say, well, that's a line we can't cross.
Yeah.
But working with people to give them the information, I think, is a really important part of getting them on side and getting them aware of the reality of how something like COVID or not having fans back impacts on the club as a whole. So, yeah, I think to your point earlier as well, and this gets me thinking, I think Mallorca's a really fascinating place as well. I look at it as different. You know, as you said, it's an island. I grew up in an island.
Yeah.
So when I've had Mallorcans say to me when I first started, well, you know, you're not from Mallorca, you don't know islanders, you know, we're Mallorcan. And I'm like, hang on a minute.
Stinky Bay, I've been back. Yeah. I know Stinky Bay and Grenay.
Come to Jersey, we're very similar. And so that sort of disarms people a little bit. And I would always look at the, I think the unique nature of an island and the unique opportunity that comes with that, you are different. You've got an opportunity to be different. Mallorca as an island is, you know, incredibly cosmopolitan.
Huge. It has been for 4 or 5 decades.
Absolutely. So there's so many things that you can tap into. And again, going back to that sort of identity is, well, what sort of, if I was a fan of Mallorca, grew up in the island, watching my local team play, what would I want them to represent? I'd want them to be aggressive.
Yeah.
I'd want them to fight. You know, Mallorca's been invaded for thousands of years.
Yeah, yeah.
They can fight.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they produce fantastic athletes. You know, Olympians, Rafa you talk about. You see young kids going up mountains on bikes age 8. You know, they live in their environment.
The outdoor life is a big thing.
Rowers. Yeah. You know, and there's a grittiness about, for me, again, it's a huge stereotype, I don't know, but it's something I noticed, hard-working people, and I think, well, that represents the island. So, as a team, we've got to wear that shirt with those values.
It's quite, if your project, I know that you're not getting carried away because you said very clearly the main thing is to keep the club in La Liga and then build and develop with the right people but if you can be part of not just re-energising the identity of the club, but help re-energise the identity of the island, an island that feels that it's overwhelmed by tourists for 6 or 7 months every year, where there's overuse of water by tourists who come, there's crazy things done in the name of progress whereby the beauty of the island might be under threat. All these things, you talked about invasion, but there's another type of invasion, which is what Majorca is, and it's very real to them. And if you're giving, if you can, say over 2, 3, 5, 10 years, give them back something that's a central place of pride when you see the red shirts and the badge and whatever. That's a really big project.
Yeah, and it sounds a bit sort of like, wow, aren't we, you know, with this sort of opportunity to do something like that. I think it's the hard work, it's the commitment, it's the day-to-day things that you bring that create something over time. Mm-hmm. So, but what we're trying to do is, you know, I think every football club, I know every single football club represents a community, whether that's in this country, whether it's in Spain. The roots of all football are in the community, and that's a brilliant opportunity, I think, for anyone. Now, pulling against that is the commercial side of football, the success of football, the salaries that fans can feel disconnected from the players because, you know, these guys are getting further away from them in terms of the relationship potentially. But, you know, in very simple terms, I look at Majorca and the work I'm doing in Majorca, and I think, well, my main responsibility is obviously my professional responsibility to helping put in my ideas that help make that club successful, but also the relationship between the fans and the club and get them behind us, because those experiences, like you said about the Deportivo game, sitting there in a stadium full of fans, sharing that moment, you can't replace that. Now, whether you're a player doing it or someone who's, you know, has a tiny involvement in the way that I do to an extent, it doesn't matter. It's the connection between all of those things happening at once. And yeah, we have a relationship, obviously, with the council, with the island, with the Balearic Tourist Board, for instance. We're very aware of our place, and I think that any sporting occasion, anything that brings people together to celebrate an event, and whether that, you know, again, you walk away 50% of the time happy, 50% of the time really upset, but it's fabric, isn't it? It's what makes people, you know, makes people's week or destroys it. But people knowing that we're trying to do what we can to make the team successful and be part of, you know, part of the island going forwards. And we need their support, you know, everyone's support to help us make that happen as well.
Listen, listeners, go on your holidays, pick Majorca.
Oh, absolutely.
Go to San Mosh in the winter, wherever you are, because it's not just a British and Irish audience that listen to us. Wherever you are, you're looking for blue skies and a nice weekend, fly to Majorca, go to San Mosh, support Graham's team. It's a good way to spend your life when you're not playing. I think it's an enriching and interesting way to spend your life. And watching the club from a distance, it's really clear that the combination of your ideas and experience is working. You've chosen the coach well. Our wonderful sponsors, Bet365, support us. They've sent a range of questions. One of them that I like: the best wide player winger that you had to face. Somebody that really, whether you liked their game or respected the game or not, was a real pain in the arse to have to play against.
Well, fortunately, I played against all of the best players of my generation, and they all come with different challenges. I think standout, there isn't, because everyone, there are various problems you face as a fullback. So I think there's pace, there's trickery. So I think from a pace and a combination of the two, I would say probably Brian Laudrup. When I made my debut against
Flipping heck.
When I played against Denmark.
Yeah.
It might have been because it was my debut at Wembley. Okay. So you can imagine the context of that, having grown up in Jersey watching every cup final since I can remember. And then my first ever game at Wembley was...
First Channel Islander to play for England. Yeah.
Terry Venables' first game against Denmark, who were a phenomenal team there. Yep. Obviously, Michael, his brother, and the rest of the team were excellent. And coming up against Brian there, that was a tough, tough game because he was quick and technical, could come in, could go outside. They used him really well. He would be right up there. Figo, I played against. And again, you don't necessarily put Brian Laudrup and Figo in the same category in terms of their status, but the challenge was a different challenge, but equally as
difficult. Wide players, both of them are reasonable units.
Oh yeah, yeah,
bigger than Brian, but Brian is
he's strong. Yeah, yeah.
And Figo might not be 6'2".
Both of them are, and
yet were quick and elegant.
Absolutely, yeah. Zidane played, although he played in midfield, he'd drift out to that right-hand side. So one of the nicest feelings I ever had as a football player was when Zidane pissed off to the other side of the pitch. Because I thought, I've definitely won. I've won. Zidane's gone to left. He's gone to destroy the right back now. But even players like Angelo Di Livio.
Whoa, yeah.
Juventus.
What a worker.
We played as wing-backs, both of us. So not often did you play back three and wing-backs against back three and wing-backs. True. It was quite an unusual system then.
Yeah.
Italy did and we did. And Angelo and I played against each other three or four times in quite close succession. Massive challenge playing against him because he was...
busy and aggressive.
Physical, never gay. You know, everything about him was... And we had huge respect for each other.
So, it's nice to hear. I think he's one of those when Juve were relegated for the Calciopolis. I think he's one of those who went, no, I'm staying.
Yeah.
I'm going to build
Wouldn't
back
surprise
up.
Me.
I'm pretty sure that's
he was
right.
But look, I could reel off a list of 50 wingers and...
The great thing about your answer is you've enjoyed all of these.
Every team you play against, you know, I played against Beckham so many times. I played against Ronaldo, young Ronaldo, when he made, you know, in his first season at United. And, you know, luckily I had loads of experience and he was young and he would do 87 step overs. And with experience,
was,
you just watch the ball and then just...
It was a bit excessive, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. It reminded me of, have you seen Raiders of the Lost Ark? You know, I'm obviously very, very well read. Exactly. And then you just shoot them. Exactly.
Listeners, Graham and Neil and I both
wielded
imaginary scimitars. And then we're all waiting and then we pull out the Luger and bang, you're dead. As Graham did when he nicked the ball, Cristiano, who was standing there going, you can't do this. I'm going to be CR7.
And so again, I think when you play at that level, every single player you play against is going to have something. That Chris Waddle, I mean,
one of our earliest guests.
What a player to play against. Yeah. Left footed on the right wing, used his body like no one else.
Look what you've just done. You've done a Chris.
Yeah,
because we sat in his loft asking him, did you know how to do what you're doing? And he talked us through every millimetre.
Right.
About if your shoulder went like that, his shoulder went. How much he'd show you over the ball and what he'd do to
you.
He could talk forensically about what he did, which
absolutely.
Not everybody
could. And there weren't many inverted winningers those days. So coming up against a left footer playing on the right wing was again another challenge. And I was a younger player. So trying to understand how to control... So as a defender, your job is to take control of the winger. When he has the ball, you've got to take control of that situation. Because if he owns that situation, you're in trouble. If you own that situation, you've got a much higher chance of success, okay? So getting them into a position where you're in control is obviously the challenge. So I would either get somebody into a position where I'm showing them down the wing, or I'd get somebody into a position where I'm stopping them going down the wing and showing them not inside there, but across the pitch.
But was this always your choice, or were there sometimes team orders? Like
team
example,
order. So
George Graham always said...
Show them inside. Yeah. So we would show inside most of the time. But with Chris, you couldn't show him inside because he would just move the ball away from you. And with a left footer there, as soon as they take the ball away from you, they're moving it yards away from you, so you can never make up that ground before they've crossed it. So I would stand on Chris's left foot, outside his left foot, really, to say, you're going down there, mate. Mm-hmm. And he could go down there, that's the problem. Mm-hmm. He could also do that, but that wasn't
the better option for you. Yeah.
So that was that. But every time he did the shift, you had to do the shift as well. But by the time you've done the shift, he's already moving it away from you. So your shift is slightly after his. Does that make sense?
Well, totally. And
that's the challenge. And then the delivery or the movement into that next space could take you out of the game. Because once he's got past you, you either foul him or he's running into the box or whatever. But he was such a gifted player. Him, Steve McManaman was like that as well. He had the same body movement. And neither of them looked like athletes.
No.
As players. They didn't, did they?
No, they didn't. And also, I think both of them had a good old-fashioned, very old-fashioned, lackadaisical football. Is
great
to be one,
though,
if we can, but we're supposed to have fun. And the reason him and I are grinning a little bit is... Great. Well, apart from the fact that Chris played for Neil's beloved Falkirk, is that he talked to us about when he was on his game, particularly when he went back to Chef Wed, but when he was doing what you've described and he lost a fullback or he came inside or whatever, or he was on the ball, you could hear the clack, clack, clack.
And people standing up.
Of people. Mm. And that's why we're all at this. That's why we're still talking
about
this.
I used to get that. People stood up and I presume to applaud, but they were leaving.
Don't believe...
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Back Page. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Here endeth the lesson.